to give protection to the general mass of people who are citizens of the state is the prescribed occupational duty for a king. By acting in that way, the king in his next life shares 1/6 of the result of the pious activities of the citizens. But a king or executive head of state who simply collects taxes from the citizens but does not give them proper protection as human beings has the results of his own pious activities taken away by the citizens, and in exchange for his not giving protection, he becomes liable to punishment for the impious activities of his subjects. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. The question may be raised here that if everyone engaged in spiritual activities to attain salvation and become indifferent to the activities of the material world, how then could things go on as they are? And if things are to go on as they ought to be, how can a head of state be indifferent to such activities? In answer to these questions, the word Shreya, auspicious, is used here. The division of activities in society as arranged by the Supreme Personality of Godhead was not blindly or accidentally created, as foolish people say. The Brahmana must do his duty properly, and the Kshatriya, the Vaishya, and even the Shudra must do the same. And every one of them can achieve the highest perfection of life, liberation from this material bondage. This is confirmed in Bhagavad Gita. Sve sve karmani abhirita samshirim labhate nara. By seeing one's prescribed duties, by executing one's prescribed duties, one can attain the highest perfection. Lord Vishnu advised Maharaj Prithu that a king is not enjoined to give up his kingdom and the responsibility of protecting the prajas or citizens to instead go away to the Himalayas for liberation. He can attain liberation while executing his royal duties. The royal duty, or the duty of the head of state, is to see that the prajas, or the general mass of people, are doing their respective duties for spiritual salvation. A secular state does not necessitate a king or head of state who is indifferent to the activities of the prajas. In the modern state, the government has many rules and regulations for conducting the duties of the prajas, but the government neglects to see that the citizens advance in spiritual knowledge. If the government is careless in this matter, the citizens will act whimsically without any sense of God realization or spiritual life and thus become entangled in sinful activities. An executive head should not be callous to the welfare of the general mass of people while he simply goes on collecting taxes. The king's real duty is to see that the citizens gradually become fully Krishna conscious. Krishna conscious means completely free from all sinful activities. As soon as there is complete eradication of sinful activities in the state, then there will be no more war, pestilence, famine, or natural disturbances. This was actually prevailing during the reign of Maharaj Yudhisthira. If a king or head of state is able to induce the citizens to become Krishna conscious, then he is worthy to rule over the mass of people. Otherwise, he has no right to levy taxes. If the king looks after the spiritual interests of the citizens, he can levy taxes without difficulties. In this way, both the subjects and the king will be happy during this life, and in the next life, the king will be able to share 1/6 of the pious activities of the citizens. Otherwise, by levying taxes on the sinful citizens, he will have to share the reactions of their sinful activities. This same principle can be applied to parents and spiritual masters as well. If parents simply give birth to children like cats and dogs, but cannot save their children from imminent death, they become responsible for the activities of their animalistic children. Lately, such children are turning into hippies. Similarly, if a spiritual master cannot direct his disciples to become free of sinful activities, he becomes responsible for their sinful acts. These subtle laws of nature are unknown to the present leaders of society. Since the leaders of society have a poor fund of knowledge, and the citizens in general are rogues and thieves, there cannot be an auspicious situation for human society. At the present moment, the whole world is full of such an incompatible combination of state and citizens, and therefore there is constant tension, war, and anxiety as an inevitable result of such social conditions. Om Aginati Mirandasya Agnananjana Salakaya Chaksurun Militam Jena Tasmai Shigrave Namaha Sri Chaitanamano Vislam Stapitam Jena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dharati Svaparantikam Yakaruchi Vachalam Pangulangayate Girim. These verses are interesting because they talk about how one should behave in the position of a royal personality like Maharaj Prithu. Maharaj Prithu is a Shakyavesha or empowered incarnation of the Lord, and he ruled perfectly. Just as it's mentioned here, Maharaj Yudhisthira was a great emperor. He was the personification of religion. Even so, he's very eager to take instructions from the Lord and to glorify him when he comes present before him personally. It was discussed previously that one should always offer respect to superiors. One should be very loving and brotherly, affectionate towards one's superior equals, form friendships with one's equals and one's peers. One should be very compassionate to those who are beginning or those who are junior. These are instructions given throughout the Bhagavatam. Lord Kapila also talks of this. Mahatam bahomane nadina namanu kampayan maitra chayvat matulyeshu yamena niyamena cha. He says that one who is even a pure devotee must be very respectful and worshipful to the spiritual master, and the acharyas must make fast friends with his equals and must be very compassionate to his juniors, and all his activities must be done under regulation and with control of the senses. It's also stated in the 11th canto that a Majjhima Adhikari, one who is the role model for us supposedly, not a Kanista Adhikari who simply worships the deities, or one who claims to be on the Paramahansa platform, that one should see four things. He should see the Supreme Lord as his worshipable deity and worship him constantly, Ishware Taradineshu. He should see the general mass of people, Balisheshu Dvishatsuchat, as the innocent or young people like children. Bali means children, Balisheshu Dvishatsuchat. He should see those who are beginning as younger, should be compassionate towards them, and the Majjhima Adhikari approaches all of them like we do when we're distributing books or prasadam. We're approaching everyone. Balisheshu Dvishatsuchat. Prema Maitre Kripopeksha, he makes such friends and he avoids the envious. He sees four things. He sees the devotees. He sees the innocent mass of people. He sees the Supreme Lord, and he sees himself. And he sees in this way that one has to see others as equal to oneself, all others, not only the devotees. So the Kanista Adhikari sees the deity, and the Majjhima Adhikari sees these four things. Yat karoti samajjhimaha. That's the definition given in the 11th canto of a Majjhima Adhikari. Sees the Supreme Lord, sees his own self, sees others, and he sees the general mass, he sees the beginning devotees. He sees his equals. So these verses are talking about taking shelter, or how one takes association of devotees, what the procedures are. And in the case of a royal personality, there's a tremendous responsibility because so many people are dependent on these people. They try to take shelter of them. And those who are leaders of society, they're referred to in the Bhagavad Gita as shrestas, yadyaracharati shrestas. And it's said there that whatever such persons do, whatever they do, the common men will follow. Whatever standards they set, whatever examples they set, people will follow in their footsteps. Yat pramanam kurute lokastara anuvartate. In modern society, as Prabhupada mentioned here, the knowledge that one should attain spiritual perfection is not being conveyed and not being adopted. Therefore,
Instead of sharing 1/6 of the pious activities, leaders have to accept all of the sinful reactions. And we may recall that Vasudev Dutt personally explained to the Lord that he wanted to accept the sinful reactions of all the prajas, not only in the state, but in the world, but in the whole universe. And Lord Chaitanya was so happy to hear this, because he really meant that he wanted to take on all these sinful activities. He didn't have to. He wasn't the head of state, and he wasn't a misleading head of state. But Lord Chaitanya was so pleased that he immediately granted his request and liberated the whole universe. That's how much the Lord is pleased by selfless leaders. So the idea of taking shelter is in the minds of everyone. When Prabhupada was discussing once with some of the BTG editors how they should convey the idea of shelter, he said, one of the things you should do is explain very methodically, systematically to people how the places where they're usually taking shelter now are not actually real shelters. He specifically mentioned some of the groups. The government leaders were one. The religionists and the academics were another. The psychologists and psychiatrists were another. Scientists, psychologists, and scientists. So he wanted, part of the way Krishna consciousness should be propagated was to dismantle people's illusory conceptions, piece by piece, that they can actually gain shelter and peace and help from such illusory shelters. All such illusory shelters are either convinced themselves, many of them are, that they have shelter, that they have the right outlook, they have the right view, and that others, if they come under this ashrita, this shelter ashraya, that they will also give other people shelter and happiness and security. But as Prabhupada points out, there is tension constantly between the citizens and the state, for example, in the government realm, and there's no peace, there's no tranquility. Because the real shelter, the real goal of what shelter is being avoided. It is said in the 10th canto, Lord Brahma prays, Samashrita ye para palava plavam, mahatparam punya yasho murare, bhavam buddhir vatsa padam param param. Prabhupada said this was a very poetic verse because it says that those who take shelter of the boat of the lotus feet of the Lord, we can imagine the feet of the Lord being a boat. For those who take shelter of him who is the enemy of the Moor demon, and who is the shelter of the cosmic manifestation, the great ocean of material existence, which we're all being washed to and fro in, is compared to the amount of water in a calf's hoof print. For them, there is no anxiety, because their goal is Vaikuntha, the place where there is no anxiety, not the place where there is padam padam yadvi padam natesham, danger at every step. So somehow, it's possible to live in this material world and at the same time take shelter of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and be fixed in the feeling that one is in a boat that's protected, that's sheltered, so that this great ocean is no longer significant. It's no longer a source of great anxiety. It's just like a little bit of water. And this boat sometimes is compared to the society that Prabhupada created for ISKCON, the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. Then he's the captain of that boat, and the favorable winds are the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. So this is the shelter, really, for all people. Prabhupada wanted everyone to be able, therefore we called it a house that everyone could live in. He wanted everyone to be able to take shelter of this great house. And in this way, sooner or later, at some time, people would actually be able to feel secure, they would be able to feel sheltered, and they would be able to act according to their varnas and ashrams. If those who are practicing Krishna consciousness don't ultimately act according to the way that their life, their society is structured, or the way the varnashram is structured, and in general, if people aren't dutiful or obedient, Prabhupada once said discipline, or obedience is the first order of discipline, then there will be no peace and happiness. Shrama eva hi kevalam. It will simply be a disturbance in society. But those who can act according to their duty and obedience, they will satisfy the Supreme Lord, as Maharaj Prithu did. And they will feel happy, and they will satisfy the Lord. Samsidhim haritoshanam. When activities are performed as duty, but at the same time the Supreme Lord is satisfied by those activities, then it becomes beneficial and everyone benefits. And if the duties are not done according to his direction, or ultimately without satisfying him, then they are also considered to be useless in human society. People very much knowingly or unknowingly depend on some kind of shelter. In India still, there are many farmers. They say maybe 70 or 80% of the country there are rurally oriented. They're living in a country situation. They're out plowing the fields, and they're living a very simple life compared to what we know. So I remember when Prabhupada was present in 1967 in San Francisco, there was an incident that occurred in India. A friend of ours who was becoming a devotee rushed up to Prabhupada's room for the newspaper, and he said, "Swamiji, Swamiji, your Prime Minister has been almost killed. Indira Gandhi was stoned by the public when she came into the airport in Bombay." And so Prabhupada had him read the article. And what had happened was there had been a great drought in Maharashtra, where Bombay is located. And all the farmers, the kind of simple so-called people, were very disturbed. And they blamed the leader, the Shrestha, who was supposed to be the king upholding religious principles and protecting everybody from famine, pestilence, droughts, and so on and so forth. So without any notice, they stormed the airport. They came from near and far, and when she got off the airplane, they began to throw stones at her. They were so angry that they were not getting any water and their crops were failing. So they almost, well, she was protected, but she could have been very easily killed. Somehow she was protected. So he read this article to Prabhupada, and he was expecting Prabhupada, "Oh, that's terrible, what a horrible news." And as soon as Prabhupada heard it, he said, "Oh, very good, very good." Of course, it was regrettable that the Prime Minister was almost killed and injured, but he wanted to make the point to this person that there was still some sentiment that the leader of society, the executive head of a state, should lend protection, that people should feel dependent on such a person like they did on the Rajarshis, who are very protective. So then he went on to explain why this happened and why there was some good in it. So in the present time, we see that this phenomenon is occurring. People are in the state, in the government, they're collecting huge amounts. We're based in Washington, D.C., our communications department, and we see that in Washington, all the roads are very nicely paved, all the suburbs are very nicely laid out, and there's so many industries that are connected with the government because the government's collecting billions and billions in tax money, so they make all the buildings look very nice. They're very well kept every year down in the mall, where the devotees sometimes sing and distribute books and so on. All very nice and very clean. And they have these underground elevators and trains in case there's a nuclear attack that take them at hundreds of miles an hour way far away underground to some place in Pennsylvania, Virginia, way out under a mountain. So they're simply collecting and collecting. And at the same time, crime is increasing. More and more welfare cases, more and more drugs. Nobody knows how to stop it. Everybody's in intense anxiety. Even in Washington, it's said to be the murder capital of the world. There's so many murders right in this inner city of Washington every day. So it's also mentioned in the Srimad Bhagavatam that in Kali Yuga, if one is thinking sinful activity, sinful thoughts, because we're in Kali Yuga, one doesn't accrue the sins of thinking sinful thoughts. One has to actually perform sinful activities in order to get the results of those sinful activities. So it's a little special dispensation given in the age of Kali. But the leaders of society are tending more and more to want their post and not properly disperse the tax money for protection and for stopping the sinful activities. So they're actually guilty of the sin of both the mission and commission. They're actively avoiding giving any protection. So they're accruing a great, great deal of sinful activity by allowing the citizens. There was sometimes, Prabhupada mentioned prohibition in Bombay. I think he mentioned this in one of his books. It was for quite some time. And then because they wanted the revenue, the tax money, for liquor, they distributed it themselves and collected all the tax money. So because the people wanted to be sinful, instead of trying to make some rule or law to stop the sinful activity, they thought, all right, well, they want to be sinful, we'll let them be sinful. And we'll, as long as we can get money, it's all right. When I was young, I grew up in Oregon, all the liquor was dispensed in state-owned liquor stores. It was the same thing. They would Are they still doing that? No, I don't think so. In Virginia. So this is another way to collect money. Prabhupada once he said, you might have heard this, that Nehru, Jawaharlal Nehru, was educated in Europe, and he became a barrister. And he said, Prabhupada said he once visited his home. He wasn't there, but he saw that the home looked exactly like a British house. So it was his idea that all of these thoughts about the Supreme Lord and taking shelter in the Vedas were all mythological, and that they were impeding progress in the country. Everything should become totally Britishized. And as a result of all this, there was his successor, and there was partition, there was tremendous war and strife everywhere. And Prabhupada said that he has taken birth in Sweden as a dog, Nehru. So this is one of the ways. I don't know if he heard some astrologer said that. I don't know if it's true, but it's an indication how much it means if someone actually has to take on the sinful activity of everyone. I mean, it's a tremendously sinful a lot of activity that all the prajas, all the people are committing every day to undertake that, to take that on. That's what awaits those leaders who are irresponsible. And there was a devotee who came into Washington one day and asked about a particular senator. This senator was a sort of a friend in one sense. He'd done some things, not exactly for the movement, but I think of for some of the Asian communities. So he asked the taxi driver who's going to the temple about so-and-so. They said, oh, that guy, he said, I never met such a lush in my life. Every time I've taken him, three times, I've picked him up at the airport and taken him to his home in Capitol Hill. And he's so drunk, he said, he can't even talk. He can't even stay awake. And the car smells so bad, I can't even stand it. I roll down all the windows. So the indication is even there may be some sentiment, because the government these days, especially in this country, I guess everywhere, is so full of cheating and lies that many of these people, even if they're a little good-hearted, they can't even tolerate being themselves. They have to sort of drink themselves to death, tolerate all the lies and cheating that has to go on in order to be in this position. So it's become a very, very decadent society. In one of his purports, Prabhupada talks about not only the theological and philosophical importance of heads of state being pure, but he also gives some specific directions how states, heads of state, can be talked to, or how one can approach them in these days. In fact, when I was in England with Prabhupada was there, it was 1975 or 76, he said he was thinking of forming an organization called the Society of Sinless People. And he wanted to, because we were bringing to his room some important people, environmentalists, and there was a Lord this one and Lord that one, Queensway, Lord Brockway. And then he said, at one point he said, he was planning like this, and then he called us into his room about a week later and said, actually, I've given up this idea. Because he said that every time I asked them, they said, it's not possible. I can't give up these sinful activities. But sometimes devotees have had an opportunity to talk to some of these people, and they're a little receptive because, as I was mentioning, everyone's looking for shelter. And it's apparent to many leaders in society that they're not giving shelter, that they can't give shelter. And sometimes they're looking to their priests, to their mullahs or their rabbis or whatever to, you know, sort of help them because they can't do it. They want some help. So I'm going to just read this brief passage where Prabhupada is talking about some instructions that are applicable in today's age. He says, this is in the first canto, the 16th chapter. It's the 17th chapter, it's verse number 39, which says, Suta Goswami said, Maharaj Parikit, thus being petitioned by the personality of Kali, gave him permission to reside in places where gambling, drinking, prostitution, and animal slaughter were formed. And Prabhupada talks in the purport a bit how this was actually a very ingenious and intelligent way to show compassion for the personality of Kali. There was an injunction earlier on where it said that if one who criticizes the individual, the sinner, is as guilty as the sinner himself, rather it should be the sin, not the sinner. Hate the sin, not the sinner, it said in Christian literature, who should be condemned. So he was merciful in this way and gave him this place which was away from a society which could be contaminated.
So Prabhupada says, following the footsteps of Maharaj Parikshit, it is the duty of all executive heads of state to see that the principles of religion, and then he names the four, are established. The state, he says, which wants to eradicate corruption by majority may introduce the principles of religion in the following manner. So he's alluding to modern society and so-called modern democracies, among others. One, 2 compulsory fasting days in a month, if not more, parentheses, austerity. Even from the economic point of view, such 2 fasting days in a month in the state will save tons of food, and the system will also act very favorably on the general health of the citizens.
When Nelson Mandela made his first visit to the temple in Durban, South Africa, some of these points were brought up to him. And when he came back the second time for Diwali, this last Diwali, he was very receptive. He stayed for about 3-4 hours and gave up his previous appointment, which people had paid so much a plate, so many hundreds of dollars for their dinner, because he felt the devotees had something to offer.
He had a dinner with them. 2, there must be compulsory marriage of young boys and girls attaining 24 years of age and 16 years of age respectively. There is no harm in co-education in the schools and colleges, provided the boys and girls are duly married, and in case there is any intimate connection between a male and female student, they should be married properly without illicit relation. The Divorce Act is encouraging prostitution, and this should be abolished.
So there's a huge, huge expenditure now in governments. It's becoming quite scandalous to support welfare mothers who are supposed to be getting child support, and many of whom aren't. And there are, so in other words, because their husbands aren't supporting, or they're not there, or they're cheating or whatever, government is just spending massive amounts of money on the gynecology, on the obstetrics, on the support throughout one's life. So many unnecessary expenditures.
And 3, the citizens of the state must give in charity up to 50% of their income for the purpose of creating a spiritual atmosphere in the state or in human society, both individually and collectively. They should preach the principles of Bhagavatam by A, karma yoga, or doing everything for the satisfaction of the Lord, B, regular hearing of the Srimad Bhagavatam from authorized persons or realized souls, C, chanting of the glories of the Lord congregationally at home or in places of worship, D, rendering all kinds of service to Bhagavatas, engaged in preaching Srimad Bhagavatam, and E, residing in a place where the atmosphere is saturated with God consciousness. If the state is regulated by the above processes, naturally there will be God consciousness everywhere. Then he goes on to say, gambling of all descriptions, even speculative business enterprise, is considered to be degrading. And when gambling is encouraged in the state, there is complete disappearance of truthfulness. Allowing young boys and girls to remain unmarried more than the above-mentioned ages and licensing animal slaughterhouses of all descriptions should be at once prohibited.
These are very also very heavy things, which can immediately benefit states. I was just thinking the other day that if even one of these fast food chains switched over from meat to even something like soybeans, which is maybe not very nutritious, but it's not like sinful, and it's very, very inexpensive, then they could increase their profits like 400, 500, 600%. And if they made a good propaganda at the same time, then they could probably get their competitors, their industry, to follow suit. But they're just locked into this idea that people have to have this particular taste and so on, and it's immensely destructive. I remember there was it Northwest Airlines? Yeah, they banned smoking on their flights about 10 years ago, and within a few months, all of the other airlines did the same thing in domestic flights in the United States. And then, of course, gambling. It's another situation where the heads of state, they collect huge taxes. Where did they just make it legal? Some state. I can't remember. But I know in New Jersey, when it was first made legal, it was a huge amount of income. They were getting low on money, so they thought, great, we'll make gambling legal. And, of course, in Nevada, they have probably the majority of their revenue comes from there.
The flesh eaters must be allowed to take flesh as mentioned in the scriptures and not otherwise. Intoxication of all the scriptures Even smoking cigarettes, chewing tobacco, or the drinking of tea must be prohibited.
And I don't know if any of you, well, I'm sure some of you, if you've gone to Singapore, on the landing card when you go in there, you have to fill out where you're going to stay and where you're from and so on and so forth, like most countries have. But there's, in a little red, not little, big red letters, it's about a postage stamp in size, and it's very bold. It says, "Death to drug smugglers in Singapore." And they really mean it. If you get caught smuggling drugs, there's no trial. You just die. You get executed. And when there's executions there, they have the pictures of the people who were executed on the front page of the newspapers. And it's like a police state, but at least they don't have any drugs. People are afraid. And there's another Vedic principle they follow, that's corporal punishment. When someone steals, instead of just putting him in a cell for days or weeks or months on end and having to pay for all that, one estimate was to keep one prisoner in jail cost over $100,000 for 1 year. It's more than most executive salaries. They cane them. They have this bamboo, big piece of bamboo. They soak it, and then some huge, brawny person, weighs about 300 pounds, whacks them on the backside a certain number of times according to the degree of seriousness of the offense. And it's so painful that some of them pass out from the pain. So it's a great deterrent also, because people just don't want to have to undergo that pain. It's different from sitting in a jail cell where you're getting three meals a day and watching TV and reading sex magazines all day. So it's a deterrent, and it's part of the laws of Manu, an eye for an eye and corporal punishment too. They cut off their hands, I think it was said. In Iran, they still, of course, it's a bit draconian. I think they cut their arms off. They used to, at least, under Khomeini. So anyway, these are some of the things that the Prabhupada mentioned are important and can be implemented, maybe not, instantly in the immediate time, but that there is a place for such kind of preaching. And he advised devotees, if they had such inclination, that they could preach in this way. Let's see. What time does this class go to?
9:00.
Oh, okay. So Prabhupada writes in the purport, as soon as there is complete eradication of sinful activities in the state, then there will be no more war, pestilence, famine, or natural disturbances. There's another purport which I always remember. Prabhupada says that if the leading citizens, if only the leading citizens of the state would give 50% of their hard-earned income to advance spirituality, then this hell of pandemonium, meaning this planet, would be turned into the spiritual world. And he was giving that indication. So much is the mystic potency of one who engages in devotional service that effect would be had. I think, who was it? Somebody was, I think it was here, was giving a class, and they gave a quiz. And they said, if all the wealth in the world were equally distributed to every man, woman, and child on the planet, whatever it is, about 5.5 or 6 billion, what would the figure be? Was that here? Does someone remember? Maybe it was in another temple. But anyway, there was a statistic given that if all of the wealth, if you took it, converted everything into dollars and distributed equally to every man, woman, and child, does anyone want to guess? Yeah?
I think it's a little over $1 million.
A little over a million. Any others? Well, you won the prize. What can I say? It's $1 million. Give them a set of Bhagavatams. Huh? That was $1 million. It was $1 million. So it's inconceivable, really, but somehow that was worked out by somebody. Just imagine if you, the leading people, gave their money, how the world would be transformed. So in one sense, too, we can say that although these are the great Rajarishis who are supposed to be responsible for the prajas, that Maharaj Priest is also setting an example, and for everyone, it's said that one follows the great persons. And according to the Majjhima Adhikari principle, or the directive, the mandate, one is also supposed to try to give shelter to others, even though one may not be in that position, especially since
Prabhupada's movement is meant to be a place for everyone to be able to take shelter. So in some of the passages in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, it's mentioned that one has to, as a devotee, try to give shelter to as many as possible. And as Bhaktivinoda said, our life or our spiritual acumen or accumulation, our pious activities, whatever we want to call it, our worth, net worth as a devotee, is sometimes measured in how many we give shelter to, or how sometimes we can say it by how many people we've preached to. Books to or prasadam to, that one approaches anyone and everyone. So in that sense, the shelter is supposed to come from everyone. It's from Prabhupada's movement. It's meant to give shelter to everyone. And as individuals, all devotees try to take that position. And it's when one isn't taking shelter of false masters, it's much easier. The Supreme Personality was very, very pleased. It's mentioned in this chapter when Prita Maharaj was offered benedictions, he didn't want anything for himself. He said, all I want to do is glorify you. So this actually pleased the Supreme Lord, and it qualified him to give shelter to the others. He didn't want any material shelter, and he wasn't envious. So if one sees heads of state, wealthy people, important people, famous people, and associates with them without envy, but simply with the idea that I must give this person shelter, that I must convey Krishna consciousness, then it's possible for such a person to also give shelter or to become a shrestha for all persons to follow. At one time I was writing letters. I was thinking I was being a big-time preacher to Supreme Court judges and other big people. So I wrote to Prabhupada and asked him, is this okay? Am I on the right track? Am I doing the right thing? And Prabhupada said, if you can get such people to actually preach for you, then that is first class. Otherwise, we have to concentrate on the masses. We're a movement of the masses. And then he gave the example of, at that time there was a presidential race between a Senator McGovern and Richard Nixon, and he said that Richard Nixon won because he had gotten support of the masses, whereas Senator McGovern, even though he was a bit of a gyani, had so many high-class followers, he was a professor and so on, he didn't succeed. So then I realized, yes, if one can somehow be non-envious of such people and preach them in such a way that they'll take up the preaching, then it's worthwhile. So one, like Prita Maharaj, is not envious. They're giving shelter to many people. And whenever the Supreme Lord sees such things, he's very, very happy. There was that incident with Sanatana Goswami also. Remember when he was leaving all his positions, a very, very elevated intellectual person. He knew Persian, he knew Hindi, Sanskrit, many, many languages fluently. He was a big government minister. And when he left everything behind to take shelter of the Supreme Lord, he noticed that when Lord Chaitanya just glanced at him a certain way, with a sidelong glance, that he didn't like this very opulent blanket that he was wearing. In one half a second, he realized that. So he went to the bank of the Ganga, saw an old Brahmin, and asked to trade him his old, torn, threadbare blanket for the new one. And the Brahmin said, oh, why are you joking with me? He didn't believe him, but he convinced him that, no, I really want to do this, because he was such a refined-looking gentleman. So finally he convinced him, and when he went back, Lord Chaitanya was very, very pleased. He said, now you have divested yourself of every last vestige of material attachment. That one thing. He was very, very pleased. And one of his devotees also, Kulavecha Sridhar, sometimes Prabhupada called him Ishan, was offered a benediction. He said, no, I don't want anything from you. He said, what, you're living in a house that's got holes in the thatched roof. You must be very wet in the rainy season, very cold. And he said, no. He said, I don't want any benediction from you. He said, the birds live in the nests in the trees. They don't have any roof at all. They're completely happy. They're singing. They're rising early in the morning, chirping. And I want to be like them. So Prabhupada was very, very happy. Lord Chaitanya was very, very happy. And he embraced him. He blessed him. And when Prahlad Maharaj was offered also, anything you want, Lord Nisringa said, I'll give you. Of course, he was in an opulent family. He was a king's son. But he also said, my only desire is I don't want anything for myself. I want you to be compassionate to my father, who tortured him so many times. I want you to bless all of the prajas, all the people who are suffering. And I want you to bless me that I can always remain, not personally serving you, but the servant of your servant. So in these ways, Prahlad Maharaj exemplified the kinds of blessings one should ask for the Supreme Lord, to bless others, to bless the sinful, and to give us the benediction that we can be continuously engaged in the service of the spiritual master who is giving us instructions on how to surrender to the Supreme Lord. So in this way, the Lord was very pleased with Prithu Maharaj. He was an empowered Shaktivesh avatar and incarnation, and yet he only wanted to glorify the Lord. He only wanted to take instructions from the Lord to know how to deal with his subjects. And as it is said, one should not be a leader, a father, Lord Rishabhdev's instructions, a mother, a worshipable demigod, a teacher, unless one can liberate one's charges from the grip of birth and death. And this was Prithu Maharaj's great ability to do this. So we'll stop here if you have any questions or comments. We'll take.
According to the American day that you talked about the national example, but for example, I have a problem with my brother. You know, I'm preaching him very hard about Krishna, but he's a butcher, you know, he gotta sell meat, you know, and I'm preaching him about the karma and his wife is Jehovah's Witness. The problem is I have is because I don't like to go to his house, you know. Sometimes he's angry with me because I say, if you don't listen to me, do you respect me? I have to go away from the house. He lives in Guatemala. What is the position I have to do if, you know, for example, I don't like they preach me about meat, and sometimes my wife family told my mother-in-law, She explained my children that they have to eat me. So I have problems in my family, in my wife's family. What is the position I have to do if they don't accept Krishna, you know, because I want to visit them, but I don't like the way how they preach my children, you know. I don't want to lose my children, you know. In this moment, I have problems in my family because they want to force my children to eat meat, you know, and I say, you are wrong. So that's the problem I have in my house now because I don't want to visit them, you know. So what is the position I have to do?
Whose house are they in?
Excuse me?
Who owns this house?
My wife family, you know.
Oh, your wife?
Yeah, but the reason is...
It's a big problem.
The reason is, you know, I don't go to her house, you know. My
big
house.
Problem.
Yes, and that's a big problem for me. So, but according to what he says, for example, Nelson is a big a leader, you know. But sometimes in the Bhagavad Gita, Bhagavad Gita says, you know, people who are Sudra, like that position, you know, I come from Sudra family also, you know, but now I
am
Krishna. So what is my position now? Because I have big problem, you know, with these people, you know.
Pray to Krishna for help. You have to pray to Krishna for your personal salvation, and you have to try your best to save others, but you can't force. You can't force anybody, but you have to try your best to, Prabhupada said, induce people. Prasadam is very nice. Anyway, you have to pray to Krishna for help. It's a big problem. I don't know the answer.
Yeah, but in that position, I have to keep away my kids from my wife, family, and all my family also. I gotta keep away them, or, you know, because if I go to visit them, my son is here, and sometimes, you know, I tell them, I don't want to go again to Europe with my your grandmother, because she also said then, you know, that it's good to eat fish, it's good to eat chicken, and that makes me very sick, you know, and also I go to fight with them, you know. So my position is, can I keep away my children from everyone?
You have to pray to Krishna, because people will change when they have a change of heart. They can't be forced. So if you can induce people, if you can induce them to take prasadam and in some way or other make it known that it is beneficial in every way, not just from the spiritual point of view, but from every point of view, environmental, health-wise, economically, then everybody will benefit. So pray to Krishna for strength. That's what you have to do. Yeah, Prabhupada says in one of his purports that although Hanuman and Arjuna perform difficult tasks, we may have to perform things more difficult in this age of Kali. So to transform the human mind, the human heart, from non-Krishna consciousness to Krishna consciousness, it's a great task. It's a great Herculean task. It's a miracle. But miracles happen, and they happen by the mercy of Krishna. So it's a big problem, and the bigger the problem, the more you have to depend on the mercy of Krishna to help, to pray. Otherwise, nothing can change. Yeah. Yes? In South Africa? Oh, in Armenia, the question was, did the letters that were sent to the Armenian leaders have an impact on them because they were so much harassing and hurting the devotees? It wasn't so much the government was doing it. There are some very intolerant gangs of people who, maybe some because they have a religious bias or some other reason, whatever it may be, we don't know for sure. And the police weren't helpful, but because devotees met the ambassador to the Armenian country, in this country there's an Armenian ambassador, and in other countries and wrote many letters, the situation is quieted down. There haven't been attacks anyway, and there's been some apologies on the part of them, some from Russia, which was formerly the mother country. Some of the members of the Duma, the parliament, went down there personally to intervene. So there's been a big civil rights hue and cry raised, and it's definitely had a good effect on the devotees. Although, just for reasons of security, they couldn't really protect the temples adequately. They felt so much.
Every kind of fruit, every kind of vegetable, every kind of grain, every kind of milk product, in different forms, can be offered. There's a science. And it's said also in some of the Upanishads and Puranas, other Vedic.
The situation is quieted down. There haven't been attacks anyway. And there's been some apologies on the part of them, some from Russia, which was formerly the mother country. Some of the members of the Duma, the parliament, went down there personally to intervene. So there's been a big civil rights hue and cry race, and it's definitely had a good effect on the devotees. Although, just for reasons of security, they couldn't really protect the temples adequately, they felt. So most of them have left from most of Armenia. There's still a few left in Yerevan and Kirkovian, those two cities. And the only activity they do in those cities, more or less, is they go to hospitals and they give out prasadam to the children. And one is a children's eye hospital. Another one's another that's in Yerevan, and another one's in another hospital near the Turkish border, where they give out prasadam, and it's very much appreciated by the people in the hospitals and the local government, like them very much. But because of the danger, many of them have gone away from Armenia, and some of are coming to this country, and the purpose to come here is to approach Armenian citizens who live especially in Los Angeles to get funds to help them kind of reestablish themselves in a more secure and better temple and start again. But it did have a tremendous effect. So anyone here who helped deserve thanks, because it did have a marked effect on the situation there, good effect. Yes? Okay. Compensate for it?
Yes.
The fact, okay, the question was that if one has children who is not Krishna conscious and then later becomes Krishna conscious, what can be done, and does that person incur karma, and can that karma be compensated for or eradicated by preaching to many, many other people or even more people? So the first principle is that karma can be, all karmic reaction can be eradicated by practicing Krishna consciousness, sarva dharmam pratyaya. It said that I will protect you from all sinful reactions. Prabhupada comments on that extensively on that verse in the 18th chapter in Bhagavad Gita. Also, it's in the Brahma Samhita, it's mentioned yastvindra gopamata vindrama ho svakarma bandana rupa palabhadana matanoti karmani nirdahati kintucha bhakti bhajam, that if one worships Krishna, who regulates the sufferings and enjoyments of all the peoples all over the world, one can eradicate all karma, anyone from the simplest living entity, from the Indra Gopa germ up to Indra himself. So in many other places too, if one practices devotional service, it's guaranteed that one's karma is eradicated. Maybe not instantly, but it's taken away by the power, the purifying power of the Supreme Lord. Just like water is evaporated by the sun, even from very filthy things, and it becomes pure. So One can try, if one is purified, one is more effective, because of purity is the force, as Prabhupada says, and there's many verses to back that up too, to induce others to chant the holy name of Krishna. And if one's purified, that person will be seen more and more as someone who can give shelter. So, as we were saying before, Bali Shesho Dvisachucha, one sees in the Majjhima Adhikari stage one's own children, and all others as children also. So in that Mahatma consciousness, as opposed to the miserly consciousness, one sees everyone as one's children, and the whole of humanity as one family, that there's one father. That's the Supreme Personality of Godhead, material nature is the mother. So, yeah, I suppose the answer is yes, that as far as if one becomes a purified, pure devotee, then he's not, his karma is eradicated, or it's wiped out. And whatever sinful reactions would ordinarily be suffered by one who can't deliver his dependence from death will be eradicated. But this injunction is given by Rishabhdev, that one shouldn't become a father or mother unless one can liberate one's children. It's from one who knows ahead of time, one's a devotee. And then as a devotee, one should know that if I'm going to have children, then my first and foremost responsibility is to liberate this living entity, to, in other words, make that person a devotee. That'll be a measure of my spiritual life, not just as Prabhupada says that they just breed like cats and dogs and don't have any spiritual consciousness. I think we're going to go in turn here. Yeah, these weren't the only ones that Prabhupada said should be targeted and exposed. He just gave these as examples because these were and are leaders of society. Government people are always promising we're going to maybe collect more tax or maybe not, but your life is going to get better. And people believe it and then therefore they re-elect. So they're kind of the main people that the common person thinks they're going to get shelter from. We're going to have to pay less taxes and the life somehow is going to get better. And then religionists, maybe even almost equally. See, this country has maybe more churches than any other country in the world. It's supposed to have a higher church attendance than any country except India. So people go. They go to their pastors. They go to hear the sermons. They have their church congregations and they see this as a kind of shelter. So Prabhupada wanted to point it out that there's a certain seva aparads like meat eating and many other things, but this isn't actually ultimate shelter. It's kind of a social function divested of real spiritual principles. It's religion, but it's not spiritual, not really in the true sense. And as far as science is concerned, Prabhupada lamented constantly over the fact that the idea of science, which originally comes from a Greek word which means to know. It's not just technology, but it means knowledge. That this isn't real knowledge to just build a big shoe factory, and these were the cobblers in Vedic society. Because they were handling leather all the time, they weren't even let into normal society. They were way out there, Lechit Yavana style. So, because such a huge edifice of so-called truth and knowledge and understanding has been built up in the last few hundred years about technology and science having ultimate answers about life going on forever and where we all came from. Prabhupada was very outspoken and wanted millions of dollars spent on exposing these things and establishing right science. And then psychologists and psychiatrists, again, they provide, especially in this country, shelter for a lot of people at a huge expense. If they would just chant Hare Krishna, this country would save billions of dollars in money that goes to shrinks, to psychiatrists. So I'm not meaning to put it down as a profession, because there probably were similar types of professions in Vedic times, or at least people that could help on a psychological level solve people's problems. So and there were scientists, and there were definitely academicians and religionists, and there were government people, but they were all purified. Because Krishna was at the center of life. The kings were Rajarshis. Their job was to get everyone to be Krishna conscious. And the people who were philosophers, jnanis, they were studying the Vedas constantly. They were also very detached. And science, there was a great science. I mean, there still is a great science. So if any of you read Alien Identities, you can understand there were flying machines in the past and there were yogis who could do all the things that people today can do. They could fly in the air, they could go under the ground, like the tunnel under the channel. And they could, there was Prapti Siddhi. You could, Prabhupada said, reach to from India to get a pomegranate in Afghanistan. He said one yogi came to his house, did that. So now with our computer bulletin boards, we can do that. We can type in a few keystrokes and get 50 pages of data from the other side of the world in a few minutes. So these are all mystic cities. So these modern science comparatively is very gross and very inconsequential compared to the more refined sciences that were developed. Prabhupada once compared the 747s to mosquitoes hovering around a light. He said, can you imagine the 747s, 100 747s all hovering around a light like this, never bumping into each other? So I mean, if you study it, you can see how by analyzing nature and the science of the Vedas, it was more advanced than modern science, so-called modern science. But this is not to say that these things should be rejected out of hand. The Yuktam Vairagya principle, Mumukshuvi Parityago Vairagya Pago Kachite, is to use these things in the service of Krishna. Technology, Prabhupada used, used science, used religion, used academia, the religious leaders. We interact with them in a way that they can benefit society in a spiritual way. Sananda?
Yeah, this previous question brought another question to my mind. The parents are Krishna conscious, and they have a child. Somehow, the child does not become the body, it's tasting the material world. So, what is the reaction?
If parents, the good question is if parents become Krishna conscious, and yet the children don't become Krishna conscious, is that what your question is? What's the position? Yeah? Well, that one answer is that the parents are Krishna conscious and the children aren't. But if the parents are Krishna conscious from birth, or the child was conceived under Krishna conscious principles, then there's a far greater likelihood that those unconscious Krishna conscious children will become Krishna conscious. And we've seen some evidence of that, where parents were either Krishna conscious before birth and conception was according to those principles, or after the birth of the child, that if there was a lot of proper Krishna conscious nurturing and the parents were strict devotees, that those children become Krishna conscious after a period of not being, you know, so-called Krishna conscious. The nature of Kali Yuga is so retrograde that even people raised Krishna conscious very often don't follow regulative principles. At some point they stop. And many, I don't know, I mean, I guess our movement's not old enough to have detailed statistics, but a certain percentage of them seem to come back to follow principles voluntarily. I don't know what percentage it is. It's probably a minority, but perhaps they have a greater likelihood, I would suspect they do, of coming back to Krishna consciousness at some point, if maybe only at the end of life, because it's been very deeply embedded in their consciousness and their psyches in early life. So again, one can... I remember there was a devotee in Los Angeles named Kulapriya who got kidnapped, and they tried to deprogram her, and she came out of it very successfully. But it was a very big media event, and one of the things that she was asked was, well, what would you do if your children weren't Krishna conscious? And she gave a very nice answer. She said, well, I hope they're going to be Krishna conscious. I'm going to do my best to make them devotees, but I can't force it. I'm just going to pray. So one can certainly pray and try. And by being a good example, one can hope for good results. But ultimately it's up to Krishna.
Along the same line, the spiritual master does everything he can to save the disciple. And the disciple goes away. And he goes away. Then what happens to the disciple? It seems that Prabhupada is saying the spiritual master has to accept some reaction. So is it that the spiritual master is not qualified or not following, therefore he can't say then he gets the reaction, but if he's properly situated, it's done his best.
Yeah, that's one. The question was that, because we read that the spiritual master has to accept reactions from disciples who don't follow, can it be said that if he's pure enough, then he doesn't get the reactions? And ultimately, the purifier is Krishna. As I mentioned that verse, Yastrinda Gopamata Vendana Hosva Karma. It's actually Krishna who does the purifying. And if one is a transparent instrument in that process of conveying Krishna's love and care and concern and teachings to other living entities, then that sinful reaction can pass through the person who is conveying that knowledge and that affection and go to Krishna, who is the ultimate purifier. Just like the sun, you know, it can evaporate the water. I mean, it's the sun is where the energy is coming from. It's all descending, ultimately, from the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So, depending on one's purity, one can eradicate the sins. That's a very good point. Very good. Yeah, Richard?
How should we regard leaders who aren't spiritually inclined at any level?
There's an interesting... I don't know where I read this, was in a book or it was in the conversations, but it's something Prabhupada said about Yadvad, what is it? Yad Yad Vibhuti Matsattvam. There's a verse in the Bhagavad Gita, which explains that all great and glorious things come from but a spark of my splendor. And Prabhupada quoted that verse in saying that any person who has a big position in society, they could be wealthy, famous, or influential, or somehow important, that they should be offered our respect because we should consider that they have been given some special position by Krishna. And this was mentioned, I think it was a room conversation, so it's not necessarily to be taken as universal instruction. It was according to a time, place, and circumstance. And it was in relation to offering respect to an influential and wealthy person who was going to come and visit the temple, and he wanted devotees to give him the right treatment, even though he was not, you know, fully Krishna conscious, but he was very, very wealthy. That was what it was, very wealthy, and there was some overture to ask him to help in some project in some way. So Prabhupada gave that explanation that we should treat him with great respect. So then of course, that raises the question, how can one respect persons who are not Krishna conscious or, you know, not be envious? So part of the answer is that as Madhyamadikaris, we have to approach anyone and everyone and see that people can be purified. One devotee mentioned this in a discussion we were having, that the mailman who's delivering your mail, he could be your child's guru someday. We don't know, because this is a process where we discover devotees anywhere and everywhere in any situation, and they can become, as the Shastras say, they can become not only Brahmins, they can become spiritual masters someday. So we don't know the karmic background of anyone. And therefore, if someone has already been given some kind of special grace, even though it may be material, we have to see that's a result of some kind of piety. And it may even be a result of some kind of devotional service in a past life. So we offer everyone respect. The mailman, there was that Los Angeles mailman, who was it? He, huh? Yeah, Ernie. And he chanted before he passed away, is that what happened? And he had been in association with the devotees so much that he became, you know, he got that ability to chant, which even some devotees don't do before he died. So it's always safe to treat people with respect. If there's a question of how to treat someone, everyone is actually, according to the Majjhima Adhikari directives, to be treated with great respect. Trinada Pisanichina. It's also inculcated by Lord Chaitanya, mandated that we have to treat everyone with greater respect than we accept for ourselves. No matter what they appear to be, we have to see that Krishna's in there, and they could be, you know, like I said, it could be a guru someday in this lifetime. Okay, so I think we're past. Thank you. Sorry for the delay. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. Shri Radha Giridhari ki jai. Shri Giri Govardhan ki jai. Srila Prabhupada Centennial ki jai. Jayam Vishnu Pad Paramansa Paribhajaka Charja Sto Tara Sada Shri Shri Madhis Divine Grace A.C. Bhakti Vedanta Goswami Maharaj Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Jayam Vishnu Pad Paramahansa Paribhajaka Charja Sto Tara Sada Shri Shri Madhis Divine Grace Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur Maharaj Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Ananta Koti Vaishnava Vrinda Ki Jai. ISKCON Founder Acharya Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Namacharya Srila Haridas Thakur Ki Jai. Prem Zagaho Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Adaita Gadadhar Srivasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai. Shri Shri Radha Krishna Gopinath Shyam Kundara Raghunda Giri Govardhan Ki Jai. Shri Shri Vrindavan Dham Ki Jai. Shri Shri Navaridham Ki Jai. Shri Shri Mayapodham Ki Jai. Shri Shri Ayodhya Dham Ki Jai. Shri Shri Mathura Dham Ki Jai. Shri Shri Jagannath Puri Dham Ki Jai. Tulasi Devi Ki Jai. Bhakti Devi Ki Jai. Ganga Maya Ki Jai. Jamuna Maya Ki Jai. Gaur Premanandi, Hori Nama Sankirtan Ki Jai. Hori Nama Sankirtan Ki Jai. Hori Nama Sankirtan Ki Jai. Srila Prabhupada Centennial Ki Jai. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Sri Guru and Sri Gauranga. Om Agyanati Manandasya Gananjana Salakaya Chaksurun Militam Jena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitana Manovistam Stapitam Jena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dharati Svapadantikam
This evening, I'll read from Srila Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita, as it is. Some of you may have not seen this book before. This is the Bhagavad Gita, oldest book in the world, rendered into English by Srila Prabhupada, founder of ISKCON. This is a book of 18 chapters. Each verse is very full of meaning, and any verse is very important, but tonight I selected the 26th text of the 9th chapter to read, and we'll talk a little about it after I read Prabhupada's translation and purport. This chapter is called The Most Confidential Knowledge. And it goes like this in the verse, Patram Pushpam Palantayam Yome Bhaktya Prayachati Tadaham Bhakti Upahritam Ashnami Prayatatmanaha. If one offers me with love and devotion a leaf, a flower, fruit, or water, I will accept it. This is Krishna speaking to Arjuna. Prabhupada's purport, I won't read it all because it's rather long, so I have a chance to comment a bit. Purport, for the intelligent person, it is essential to be in Krishna consciousness, engaged in the transcendental loving service of the Lord. In order to achieve a permanent blissful abode for eternal happiness, the process of achieving such a marvelous result is very easy and can be attempted even by the poorest of the poor without any kind of qualification. The only qualification required in this connection is to be a pure devotee of the Lord. It does not matter what one is or where one is situated. The process is so easy that even a leaf or a little water or fruit can be offered to the Supreme Lord in genuine love, and the Lord will be pleased to accept it. No one, therefore, can be barred from Krishna consciousness because it is so easy and universal. There are many different religious traditions existing on the face of the earth, and there have been and still are great struggles for ascendancy, for superiority. This is due to a misunderstanding, to a lack of realization, to incomplete knowledge, to offenses one commits against the original teachings of all the great sages and authorities who have traversed the earth to enlighten us, to bring us closer to pure devotional service. The thread that's common to all traditions, or to all at least major religious traditions, is that the meaning of human life is to engage in development of love for God. That is to say that everyone has a relationship, initially or originally, with the Supreme Lord. The purpose of the great saints and sages and rishis who have walked the face of the earth is to remind humanity about its essential purposes. And the original teachings are all about this essential purpose, that one can develop love for God. How exactly this is done is mentioned in books like Bhagavad Gita, which explain processes by which one can actually develop this dormant love, to revive it, to reawaken human beings to their natural position. It is said that when one becomes a lover of God by the name Krishna, we call him Krishna, others call him Jehovah, they have other names for God, Allah, thousands actually of names. But whatever name one uses, one can develop love. And it is said when this sense of genuine affection develops for the Supreme Lord, then one not only loves God, but loves all other creatures, not only one's own personal friends and family and relations, but all living beings, all human beings, the family of man, it is sometimes called, or the family of God, but all, not only human, but inhuman, subhuman, plants, animals, birds, fish, plant, trees. There is a shining from the heart of one who loves all living creatures. So we discover in Bhagavad Gita and other literatures that if the science of devotion can be understood and developed and practiced according to tested methods, then this love actually develops in the heart. And subsequently, one develops love for all living creatures. I believe it was Lazarus that was asked in the New Testament, or who asked, what is the essential teaching of Christianity? And the answer was that one should love the Lord with all their heart, soul, and might, and that one should love all creatures as one's own self. It's sort of like a golden rule, you might say. So in this verse, a very simple statement is being made, that if one offers to God or Krishna with love and devotion a leaf, flower, water, he'll accept it. This is important because this is an act that anyone can do. And it's a very simple act. It doesn't require any wealth or unusual expertise or understanding. It's a very simple act of devotion. And behind it is the understanding that not anything and everything can be taken, can be eaten. And further behind this understanding is the knowledge that there's a purpose behind everything that's on the face of the earth. There's an order to life on earth. Part of this order is how one conducts one's life in terms of eating. So the flower, the fruit, the water are particularly mentioned here. And if one studies the Vedas more deeply, one will find that there's a wide variety of foodstuffs that can be offered to Krishna. Every kind of fruit, every kind of vegetable, every kind of grain, every kind of milk product, in different forms can be offered. There's a science. And it is said also in some of the Upanishads and Puranas, other Vedic literatures, that the realization comes, the ultimate realization in this particular time and age, comes within the taste of the tongue. Svayameva Spuratyada Taksvi Krishna Namadi. It means that according to how the tongue is trained, or to taste, one can develop love for God. The way we eat is very important to us, and it's a deeply ingrained habit, how we eat and what we eat. According to Vedic literature, the human being is meant not to eat flesh of other creatures, but to eat the products that I mentioned. And they come in a wide variety of forms. So Krishna is, in this verse, specifically mentioning the things that he likes. Now, out of these simple instructions, a whole very detailed science of cooking, preparing, and offering foodstuffs to Krishna has evolved. In the present time in which we live, this science is practically lost. It's almost completely forgotten. And we live in a time and an era in which people think that they are free to eat anything and everything. This is not actually the case. People have made detailed studies about the anatomical features of human beings. And they found similarities, parallels with all the herbivore creatures and human beings, and dissimilarities between carnivorous animals and human beings. A lot of research has been done in this area, so I won't go into it. But suffice it to say that apart from being spiritually dangerous, or karmically dangerous, as we say, to eat flesh, the health of the human being is increased by the proper diet. More people in the world can eat because it's less wasteful to eat a non-flesh diet. It's less expensive. It wastes less water and oil, fuel, petroleum, gasoline used in the process of slaughtering, less electricity. So it's more environmentally friendly, the ground soil and rivers don't get so polluted when there's not so much slaughter of animals. And from the ethical and spiritual points of view, it's wholesome, much better. In some parts of the world, I was recently in India, in some states in India, and in the municipality of Delhi, the capital, there are prohibitions against consumption, importation of meat products. And some initiatives in other states are trying to prohibit this because there's still a sense of Vedic knowledge in among the 900 million or so people of India, and there's a desire to protect cows. Our Krishna Consciousness Movement also espouses this principle and embraces another principle called ox power, or power of the bullocks, the oxen, because they not only plow the fields, but they can drive irrigation machines. They can even draw machines that will saw wood and grind flour. And their manure is used as a fertilizer that doesn't contaminate the ground soil. And it's also used as a fuel for stoves and burning in India. It's even used as a cleansing agent. And some have even written that if it coats the outside of a dwelling, it can protect it from radiation. I don't know if that's true, but there's a book written about that. There's a lot of drugs, healthy drugs, that come from the waste products of cows that have been used. Sleeping, working, and recreation. These habits should be regulated, and in this way, the verse says one can conquer the yoga system. So the yoga system also means that one should be regular in one's habits. It's very important to keep a balance between eating, sleeping, and working. So that's there. It's there in the Bhagavad Gita. So these are some thoughts on this. As far as sitting and meditating silently, Prabhupada didn't recommend that, because there's a tendency to go to sleep. It's very difficult, at least for most people, not everybody. But in this age, there's a very strong tendency, if one is not attending japa, that one can sort of drift off. And material thoughts can also come into the mind. So in Bhakti Yoga, it's recommended that we can better think of Krishna if we engage all the senses. Instead of just the mind, if we engage the tactile sense by chanting with the beads, we engage the sense of hearing by hearing the mantra. We engage the sense of the taste by chanting and the tongue. And, of course, other things, flowers and incense. So all the senses are engaged. Then we'll be better off. But actually, by engaging nicely in chanting and dancing, the body becomes, and the mind, through the adrenaline that's created in the body, the mind becomes very stilled and peaceful by engaging in kirtan. So one can actually achieve that. Then you feel peaceful. You can sit and be very peaceful after chanting, in kirtan especially. Yes?
One comment also, Bhakti Vinod, he writes that Guru, he puts the seed within the heart, and then the person, the devotee, instead of just chanting with his tongue, going back to the grandson, instead of just chanting with his tongue, he invokes that.
He's not using?
He's not, you know, in other words, not creating it.
He's not creating it, yeah. Shonaka is making the point that it is said that when one is initiated, he gets the seed of devotional service, and then by constantly chanting, he's nurturing or watering that seed, that bhakti lata, and therefore it's growing, it's continuing to grow. It's not that he's creating it himself. Very good point. So one more. It's getting late.
Just to tell about that story about the drama was mentioned also in the Nectar Devotion, that when he touched the hot sweet rice with his finger, his meditation broke, because he actually got burnt. And his finger was actually burnt.
Yes. He was Vital Ishwar? His making the point that it's narrated in the Nectar Devotion that when the Brahman touched the sweet rice in his dream, in his, not his dream, his meditation,
he was actually burned, and he noticed that the finger was physically burned. This is one of the mystical events that we read about in Krishna consciousness that the empiricist cannot understand. So we'll end there. Thank you very much. Pantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.